Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with Leah Greenberg. She is a co-founder of Indivisible. We're going to talk to her about just what the plan is to get these vitally necessary democratic reforms passed through the Senate, the world's greatest deliberative body slash massive pain in the ass. And then we're going to be speaking with Eric Feigl-Ding. He's an epidemiologist and a senior fellow at the Federation for American Scientists. We're going to talk to him about where we're at with COVID, with these strains that keep popping up, and the risk of what he calls playing whack-a-mole for quite a bit of time. But first, a couple of items I want to talk about. The Biden administration is and his allies on Capitol Hill, obviously, are introducing their immigration overhaul. This is one thing that I want to say about this is it is a comprehensive immigration reform. It's been bandied about since 2000. I think the first time they introduced a comprehensive immigration reform in the Congress was 2005 or 2004, something like that. And what I want to say is that this stuff gets just demagogued by the right as amnesty, which it is not. It does have an onerous process whereby undocumented immigrants can gain citizenship over an 8-year period, paying lots of fines and back taxes, etc., etc. But the thing about comprehensive immigration reform that you really need to understand is that it is not a liberal measure. It is not a liberal measure. What it is the perfect iteration of centrism. It is perfectly bipartisan. It is a package that has an equal measure of things that conservative immigration restrictionists want and things that more progressive immigrant rights advocates want. And it combines all those things. So there's stuff in comprehensive immigration reform bills that you will hate no matter what you think about immigration, but there's stuff in those bills that you will also like no matter what you think of immigration. And this is important to notice, to point out, because the mainstream press accepts the Fox News framing of this as some sort of liberal measure. It is true that Democrats have been pushing it for the last 15 years or so, but again, this was something that George W. Bush supported. It has had majority support in the Senate, bipartisan support by Republicans as well. Now, what is going to happen with that? Well, it's unlikely to get 60 votes in the Senate. And that's not because it's unlikely to get 60 votes in the Senate, regardless of whether there is 60 members of the Senate who would like to support it, because the conservative information infrastructure, the conservative media, has made a punishment system, created a system of punishments for those who work with Democrats to govern. And the thing that is interesting about this bill, the reason that I bring it up, is that this is a bill that's gotten 55 votes in 2000. Whenever the last time it was brought up in the Senate, it got 55 votes. I don't remember which year that was. And Republicans don't need to filibuster everything. They don't need to require 60 votes for everything. That is something that is that's an innovation that Mitch McConnell came up with in 2007 when he took over the Republican leadership, is saying everything needs 60 votes. So this is something that could pass with a majority and will not pass because of the filibuster. And that is important for getting us to the point where the pressure that we're going to talk about with Leah Greenberg on senators who do not support a pro-democracy agenda, that is going to build up as we see Republicans block popular legislation. So we need this process, right? We need to put bills on the Senate floor, let Republicans block them, then go back to the entire Democratic caucus and say, look, this is the choice that you have. You can eliminate the filibuster, or at least reform the filibuster, or you can govern. You can't maintain the filibuster and govern. That's not going to happen. So there's Mike Donilon. So this is a related thing. He's a senior advisor to President Biden. He put out a memo to White House staff this week, and he said that the GOP opposition to the COVID package is going to kill them politically. And he wrote in this memo, which was obtained by Axios, quote, "There seems to be a growing conventional wisdom that it is either politically smart or, at worst, cost-free for the GOP to adopt an obstructionist partisan base politics posture. However, there is lots of evidence that the opposite is true. This approach has been quite damaging to them." And he cites various polls that show that the Republican brand is not doing well, and that Biden has a pretty good approval rating, and there's overwhelming support for the rescue package. The problem is Republicans have insulated themselves from Democratic accountability. And so all of this is a huge test. The next couple of years, this is the huge test of whether we're going to, you know, have a democracy going forward and have a level playing field for that democracy. So related to that, Montana Republicans are considering a bill that would designate Antifa as a domestic terrorism group. That is Montana. This stuff is laughable. I mean, I think it's funny in a way, just because it's so stupid. There is no Antifa activity in Montana, first of all. No Antifa members have ever committed an act of terrorism. There is no domestic terrorism statute. It's just stupid on so many levels. And of course, Antifa has been this big boogeyman for the right. And they just claim anybody they don't like is Antifa, right? I mean, the AP did an analysis of all these people who were arrested in the Black Lives Matter protests back in the summer. And, you know, they were always called Antifa on Fox News, and none of them were Antifa members, right? But as much as it's laughable, this stuff is stuff that we need to take really seriously, because it's classic fascism to, you know, find this scapegoat, a fake scapegoat, and just demonize that scapegoat and justify all sorts of dangerous authoritarian and or violent tendencies by, you know, you're protecting people from this fake bogeyman. It's difficult. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Leah Greenberg. Why don't you stay tuned? We'll come right back.
You and can say to me.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. I am very pleased to welcome Leah Greenberg to the show. Leah was one of a handful of former congressional staffers who wrote this thing, Indivisible, a practical guide for resisting the Trump agenda, which went viral and then led to the creation of Indivisible, which is now a major progressive advocacy group with chapters across the country. Leah, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I know you are in Austin, Texas. Are you and yours okay?
Thank you. We are doing well. We're very fortunate that we are very close to a firehouse, and so we have been able to avoid the really sustained power outages that a lot of people have been experiencing. But it's hard to overstress how scary the overall situation has been for folks here, and how devastating it is, and how we're going to be learning, you know, hearing about what's happened, how many folks have died, the trauma that people have been through for a long time. You know, fundamentally, there's been just almost no reliable communication from the government on what to expect. There's an overwhelming sense that nobody's got the ball. It's very clearly a massive failure of Republican governance that there needs to be an accounting for.
It's such an important point that when you don't have clear communication, that really compounds the sense of danger and instability. I hope you guys are staying safe and warm. And I thank you for taking the time to speak with me in the middle of this horrific occurrence. Let's talk a little bit about saving democracy. There is a bill in the House of Representatives called H.R. 1, the For the People Act. It's a potential game changer, or would be. Can you give us a really brief summary, like a bird's eye view of what this legislation would do?
Absolutely. Well, it's hard to cover all of the great things that H.R. 1 does. It's a really thoughtful and comprehensive piece of legislation, but it makes major advances on a whole host of issues, from small dollar donor financing to setting up independent gerrymandering commissions to avoid partisan redistricting, to automatic voter registration, which would greatly enhance access to voting around the country. Now, it's part of an overall package of pieces of legislation that Democrats are attempting to move along with the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and what we think is a really equally crucial piece of this, which is DC statehood, which are all hopefully moving through the House within the coming month or so.
We had Representative John Sarbanes on the show a few weeks ago to talk about the details of H.R. 1 a little bit more, and I encourage listeners to check out that show in the archives. As Leah mentioned, this effort should be seen in tandem with the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, H.R. 4. And if you're interested in these numbers and getting in touch with your representatives, the D.C. statehood bill is H.R. 51. And then H.R. 1 also establishes a commission to study D.C. statehood and stuff like that. So we have this vitally important legislation. It can't be passed through the process known as budget reconciliation, which allows the Senate to pass measures with a simple majority. And Republicans view expanded voting rights and nonpartisan redistricting and the like as existential threats to their party. I personally think that it would make them better in the long run to be forced to compete for voters and expand their appeal to a larger swath of the population, but they certainly do not see it that way. And meanwhile, we have these at least two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of, is it Sinema? How do you pronounce it?
Sinema? Sinema, as far as I understand it.
Sinema. Kristen Sinema of Arizona, and they say they will not vote to even reform the filibuster, much less eliminate it. And there are others that have who have been, I think, less definite, but signaled that they are also in favor of maintaining the status quo in the Senate. I'm extremely interested in whether you think that Manchin and Sinema are more malleable than they say. Do you believe that they are giving Republicans like an opportunity to prove that they will obstruct everything so that they can turn around and say, oh, well, it's sad that Mitch McConnell forced our hand? Or is this another situation like we saw in like 2009 or 2010 when senators like Joe Lieberman and Max Baucus and others seemed willing to blow up the Democrats' kind of signature Affordable Health Care Act if their concerns weren't addressed? Your thoughts on that?
It's a great question. I'd start by saying that I think that when you're thinking about kind of the two senators or small number of senators who might be those pivotal votes, it's important to first start with the atmosphere around them, which I think is really dramatically different than it was in 2009. At that point, really the entire caucus or the vast majority of the caucus viewed keeping the filibuster or getting rid of the filibuster as unthinkable. There was not a critical consensus in favor of it. There was not remotely the same recognition that Republicans were going to try to run this obstruct and blame playbook on President Obama at the time. That's changed a lot over the last 10 years. People understand that Mitch McConnell is not negotiating in good faith. And a lot of people across the Democratic ecosystem, not just us lefties, people understand that Democrats are going to be judged based on whether they get things done, not on exactly who and how many people voted for the legislation that ultimately had an impact on people's lives. There is a lot of pressure that is moving, and you know, President Biden. We were concerned early on that President Biden would go down the path of extended efforts at bipartisan negotiations that would ultimately just be a kind of a mirage. That's not what he's done. He has been cordial. He's been engaged with Republicans who claim that they're interested in a compromise, but he is continuing to move major legislation. And while we have some concerns about specific things in that, that is an overall very important strategic orientation. So I would say that the first test that we're seeing in terms of the reconciliation package that they're talking about moving the relief work in, relief bill through, that's a very hopeful sign overall for the ecosystem in which these concerns about the filibuster are existing, which is that there is, unlike in 2009, there is a critical consensus that ultimately Democrats are going to be judged on whether they get things done, and that the best way that they secure a midterm victory in 2022 is to genuinely produce for people.
You know, I think one of the big differences is obviously the experience of 2009, 2010, right? All these people lived through that. I believe that there were 188 Republican amendments to the Affordable Care Act before they voted against it in a block. So they basically spent a very long time. I don't remember. I think it was 9 months. They had this protracted process attempting to get bipartisan support, and they just bailed at the end of that process. But it's also, I think it's becoming kind of conventional wisdom among Democrats that if they don't pass some of these reforms, Republicans are just going to engage in ever more egregious, like, gerrymandering and voter suppression. I mean, is that something that you see as kind of widely understood?
I think so. And I should say, we actually wrote a sequel to The Indivisible Guide for precisely this moment. The original Indivisible Guide reflected on our experiences as congressional staffers in 2009, 2010, watching the Tea Party rise and sort of helping people figure out how they would replicate that model. This sequel is about what did Democrats do that left them open to an obstructionist movement claiming victory? And how do we avoid that? So how do we recognize up front that Republicans are going to act in bad faith? How do we prevent Democrats from getting cold feet? How do we expect and counter a grassroots right-wing resistance? And then ultimately, how do we go big on the things we need? So we're trying to continue to consolidate and push that strategic judgment at the same time. And we're seeing really enthusiastic response across the grassroots to it. I also think that it is super important to call out President Trump's or big lie, the idea that the election was somehow fraudulent or stolen. It is having real consequences in the states. It is being used by Republicans very cynically to turbocharge their already existing voter suppression efforts. There are a dizzying wave of voter suppression legislative efforts in the states right now, particularly in Republican-controlled states, on the way. We should expect that Republicans will be attempting to shape the playing field dramatically heading into 2022 in that regard. And simultaneously, they've also got the winds at their back on the census because they've been able to hold a number of House legislatures because of the horrible way in which the Trump administration conducted the census. They're in great position to gerrymander their way back to power without ever winning a majority. And if there is not a recognition among Democrats that this is an existential threat for democracy, I think it is beginning to register across the board that it really is.
Yeah. We're going to have Ari Berman from Mother Jones on the show, I believe, next week to talk about some of those specific efforts going on at the state level. They are absolutely egregious. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what you folks at Indivisible are doing to influence this debate with this initiative called the For the People Project, and which listeners can check out at forthepeople.indivisible.org. Tell us about this, what the strategy is, and how people who are listening and understand how important this is can get involved.
Absolutely. Well, the For the People Project is an effort that's really a long time in the making for us. Almost immediately after the 2018 midterm elections, we started to really bring forward and center democracy reform in our own work and across the movement. And that was really drawing on what we heard from people all over the country, which was that folks who had gotten involved in order to stop Trump had not ended there in their political analysis. They were taking a look at the rules that had allowed Trump to rise. They were taking a look at how our democracy had been rigged. And they were really eager to take on challenges like gerrymandering, like voter suppression, like the packing of the courts by right-wing hacks. The movement to stop Trump was really a pro-democracy movement. And that aligned with the strategic analysis that Democrats, if they won in 2020, were going to have this very short window of a Democratic trifecta where you could actually reset the rules to make them fair and inclusive for our democracy, to make our democracy more representative. And that if we didn't do that, we were going to be in enormous trouble, or specifically our democracy was going to be in enormous trouble.
Yes.
And we started to try and build out, what is the grassroots movement that can get behind all these things as soon as Democrats have power, because we know that it's really only a matter of a couple months where major legislation is actually going to be moving. So the For the People Project is really the launch of all of those efforts together. It's about pushing those three critical pieces of legislation, HR 1, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and DC statehood, across the finish line. And it's really both a 50-state strategy and a targeted strategy. So everywhere it is important for folks who have Democratic representatives to be pushing them hard on the urgency of these bills and the boldness of these bills. We do not want to have things that could be potentially transformative, like public or small dollar donor financing. We don't want that watered down. We need to make sure that all of these get across the finish line together. And we need Democrats to understand that, you know, while they sort of sometimes think of these issues as being dry, as being, you know, not the things that get people out of bed in the morning, we view them as critical for the sustenance of our democracy, and they're going to be held accountable for whether or not they do them. That's the first piece. Another piece of this is about leadership and making sure that leadership really understands those concerns. So Indivisibles in New York, in California, in Illinois have been working hard to advocate directly to members of Democratic leadership around exactly what we need and what we need to see here. And then, of course, there's also pushing the folks who are going to be the last votes and the holdouts on this. So folks in Arizona are coming together to do rallies, to do sign-on letters, to do events pushing Senator Sinema, really making sure that people understand that this is a top priority of the grassroots, that we don't think that this is about like, oh, we beat Donald Trump and so now we're going home. No, we beat Donald Trump and we're fighting for an inclusive democracy, and the folks that we help put in office need to help us get there.
Yeah. This is the most pandemic interview in that your dog was barking and then my dog started barking.
That's not right.
They're the stars of the pandemic, if we think about it. I mean, where would we be without the dogs? God, it would be terrible. Adam Gentleson, who was on the show recently, he was used to be deputy chief of staff to then Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid. He said that he thought only two or three strong no's was a very good whip count for filibuster reform. So we need to remain, I think, optimistic. Keep pressure on our lawmakers, because this is the ball game here, folks. If we don't get these bills, that's HR 1, HR 4, and I think to a lesser degree HR 51 passed, and HR 1 and 4 are the big ones, you know, we are just inviting more entrenched minority rule. So I would just urge everybody to educate yourself about these issues. You can listen to our episode with John Sarbanes, and check out forthepeople.indivisible.org. Leah Greenberg, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Eric Feigelding. Stay tuned.
Hear them say, dreadlocks can't live in a tenement. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement, yeah. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement, yeah. Too much su-su-su-su-su, too much watchy-watchy. Too much su-su-su-su-su, too much watchy-watchy, yeah. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement, yeah. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement, yeah. Too much su-su-su-su-su, too much watchy-watchy. Too much su-su-su-su-su, too much watchy-watchy, yeah. Dreadlocks can't live in privacy. Anything him do, old nigga see. Too much watchy, 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 too much su 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 su. Too much watchy, 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 too much su 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 su. Dreadlocks can smoke and pipe in peace. Too much informers and too much beats. Too much watchy, 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 too much su 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 su. Too much watchy, 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 too much su 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 su. Dreadlocks can live in a tenement yard. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement yard. Can't penetrate in a tenement yard. Can't penetrate in a tenement yard. Skip, skip, oh, 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 oh. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement yard. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement yard. Too much su 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 su. Too much watchy watchy watch. Too much su 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 su. Too much watchy watchy watch. Dreadlocks can't penetrate the rain, man.
All he might do is sell Jaja land. Too much watchy, too much so. Can't penetrate in a tenement, yeah. Can't penetrate in a tenement, yeah. Dreadlocks get licking pipe in peace. Too much informers and too much beer. Too much watchy, too much so. Too much watchy, too much so. Can't hide it in a tenement, yeah. Can't hide it in a tenement, yeah. Dreadlocks get licking pipe in peace. Too much Babylon and too much love. Too much
Welcome back. I realized we haven't talked about COVID for a while. Still a big deal. This week we will hit 500,000 confirmed deaths from the pandemic in the United States, which is almost certainly an undercount. So I am happy to welcome back Eric Feigelding to the show. Eric is an epidemiologist and a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. Eric, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me back. It's been a thank long you. Year.
It has been an incredibly long year. You were one of the first public commenters to raise the alarm about COVID-19 way back in early 2020. And you were called out by some people as an alarmist. I continue to be struck by our kind of bad luck, the world's bad luck, in that this historic public health crisis hit at a moment when a number of important countries were being governed by crackpot populists, right? And I'm not just saying Donald Trump, because Boris Johnson pursued a disastrous herd immunity strategy in the UK. You've got Bolsonaro in Brazil saying it'll go away. We just need to take a hydroxychloroquine, Vladimir Putin, etc. And I wonder how the course of the pandemic might have been different if we had more like technocratic leadership. You know, that word's got a bad connotation, but it is the case that, you know, we had a robust pandemic response system in place, you know?
Yeah, we had a pandemic playbook once upon a time that was completely thrown out. The global security a pandemic office that would have handled pandemics was closed down in the National Security Council under John Bolton. And we've, of course, have this right-wing anti-science, anti-fact, you know, just reality distortion field that was built up to, you know, hide so many other right-wing misinformation, but was also completely used and abused for, you know, creating this anti-mask thing, anti-lockdown thing, anti-vaccine thing now. And it's just been so, so dangerous. And of course, the pro-herd immunity with Scott Atlas and his army of bots. Actually, after he pushed it, there was literally half the people tweeting on Twitter, pro-herd immunity, natural infection herd immunity, was actually bots, according to our analysis at FAS, Federation of American Scientists, where I'm based. And that's just so, so dangerous. But here we are, because of all this authoritarian right-wing echo chamber, we are in this weird state in which people don't believe or take seriously government leaders and government action recommendations.
Yeah, it's really disconcerting for me. I live in a place where there's indoor dining, and I walk by these places, and they're packed with people who are not wearing masks, and they're eating and drinking as if things are normal. And I don't believe that we have gotten to the point of vaccinating enough people that I have confidence, oh, these people probably have gotten their vaccine, right?
Right. We're not even close to that. You know, even Israel is at almost 80 shots per 100 people, you know, two shots per person. Even they still have a long ways to go, and they're still seeing outbreaks among their young adult population. And we're like fivefold below Israel right now. So we're not even close to anywhere in sufficient vaccinations for production.
Now, when do you think we'll get back to some semblance of normal? And is that an answerable question? Am I asking you something that just can't be answered?
It can be answered, but I would like to sometimes emphasize that, you know, as they say in Terminator, there is no fate but what you make. And the future is not set in stone. We can change it. And so I don't like, you know, some people call me Dr. Feigel Doom. I don't emphasize the doom part. I emphasize precaution. And what we do now, the precautions we take, the public policy actions that we impose, the mandates, the recommendations, the policies, they make the difference. They will change the tide of this battle against COVID. And it means going back to school, potentially, for all of our kids sooner. It means business returning to normal, life returning to normal. But the longer we fight against that tide, resist, the longer this will drag out. And the greater the chance we'll have an endemic in which this virus just keeps circulating. And so, like you mentioned indoor dining earlier, it's kind of shocking. For example, New York is reopening indoor dining and restaurants at a higher level caseload, hospitalization, and death than when they initially closed down. And which makes almost no sense. And, you know, it's like if you were eating bacon and sausages your entire life and you went cold turkey because your doctor said you had a high blood cholesterol, high blood sugar, and you went vegan for a month. And all of a sudden, after your vegan, you know, mitigation lockdown month, you suddenly go back to bacon. It's not like bacon is not going to harm you anymore. Bacon is going to do its bacon thing the moment you go on a bacon and sausage diet, right?
Yes.
And so I don't know how people delude themselves to thinking, you know, you can just go back and reopen and nothing bad will happen. And this is why we have to just go for zero COVID. Because unlike cholesterol and blood pressure, you can actually go for zero with COVID. And once you're at zero, you can have a normal life again, concerts, you know, you can go mosh pits and nightclubbing like they do in New Zealand and Australia. They paid the price early on, and they learned that a small little bit of sacrifice early on reaps, you know, tons and tons of rewards and freedoms. And if anything, that gives you more freedom if we go for zero COVID faster and sooner.
I mean, one of the great frustrations that I've had is that we did lock down much of the economy in a effort to gain time to build up our contact tracing and testing capacity. We just didn't do that. So it was almost inevitable that when we reopened things without having a vaccine widely distributed, without having any more immunity, this was going to come roaring back. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk a little bit about these variants, the mutations that mm-hmm. are popping up. It was just reported, yesterday or the day before, this new one, a new variant, B1525, mm-hmm. has popped up in Britain. It is similar to the mutation that has come out of South Africa and Brazil, these variants that my understanding, and let me ask you about this because I'm sure you have a better sense of it than I do. This isn't my field, but my understanding is that there's like this unique shape that the COVID virus has, a spike. Mm-hmm. And this particular mutation makes it harder for our immune systems to recognize that. Can you explain what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. So the spike protein, what people have done, it has a lock and key relationship with our ACE2 inhibitor, okay? ACE2 receptor. And basically, if you bring a key that fits this receptor, your body cell grants entry to whatever entered, right? It's like the spike protein is like the key master, you know? And so basically, but the problem is some of the spike proteins are better fit. Like, you know, when you cut a key, some keys are better fit, right? It goes smooth in, turn, lock in key, super efficient. While some keys, you have to jiggle it a little bit before you kind of get the door open. And so the original spike protein was like imperfect. It wasn't designed for it. It just so happened that it works, right? But now the virus is evolving and realize that viruses that have a more efficient lock and key will have a more perfect and faster recognition. And that means it spreads faster, right? And so I think what people don't understand is the virus will keep trying to learn new things so it will actually achieve that level of perfection. And it means higher viral load. It means potentially also evading antibodies that attack the spike, because antibodies will recognize the spike based on what it's previously seen, whether it's presented by a vaccine or presented by a previous infection. Ah, I know you. I've seen you before. You're one of those dangerous guys. And then your body will attack it. But then if it changes enough, they won't recognize. It's like a facial recognition software when you wear a mask, right? Your Apple Face ID doesn't work anymore because it looks different to the computer, different to the human antibodies. And so this is why all these mutations happen. And the longer we have it circulating around, when we have millions and millions of people being infected, that is going to keep happening. It's going to stumble in someone who's kind of like have a semi-poor immunity, and it's going to basically mutate in these people. And over several months, we've seen many examples of people just developing super viruses that are super efficient spreaders, super evasive against human immunity and antibodies. And that's kind of how the B.1.17 variant in UK happened. And this is why we got to stop it. Zero COVID is the way. Because if we keep letting it spread Scott Atlas herd immunity style, you're going to get more of these.
This is such a crucial point for people to understand, is that the it is the virus raging through the population that gives it so much opportunities to mutate. And I think one concern that I've heard epidemiologists say, and concern that I share, I think, is that you have these great disparities in, you know, who's getting the vaccine, who's getting it first. Wealthy countries are buying up a lot of vaccine stocks. Mm-hmm. They're getting ahead in terms of vaccinating their populations. They're getting ahead of the global south. And I think a lot of people are worried that the pandemic will continue to simmer in poorer countries for for years to come. Mm-hmm. And during that time, it'll continue to mutate and new strains will come along. And perhaps some of those won't respond to the vaccines that we have as well. And then those will then be able to start brush fires in the wealthy countries that hog the vaccines in the first place.
Right, right. And it's interesting now you bring this up. First of all, we're already seeing that happening. Like the B.1.351 variant from South Africa, that one is highly evasive of previous infection. And actually, in one of the studies, they saw that previous people who were infected had no protection against this new variant, like almost none. And for vaccines, it was like about 2/3 as effective as the original. And so we're seeing this already. And the longer we let it circulate, the more this will happen. And the other thing is, you know, we also use a lot of drugs like monoclonal antibodies and convalescent plasma. And those things actually drive the virus evolution if you use it in a chronic patient. So these drugs will also like spur a long term. They work. It's kind of like antibiotics resistance. The more you use it, the more the virus or bacteria learns how to resist it. And so we got to stop it. And so this, you know, 10 countries in the world have hogged 75% of all vaccines so far, and 130 countries have had zero shots administered, basically. And that's incredibly, incredibly kind of shameful. Like, this is the pandemic. If you don't solve the pan-global pandemic, you're going to still be playing whack-a-mole with this. And similarly with animals, you know, if this virus keep transmitting, it's going to go to animals, it's going to find a reservoir, and previously they found in minks, right? Millions of minks have to be culled, but that's just tip of the iceberg. If it becomes so endemic everywhere, it's going to basically have this pool of animals to infect and eventually cross infect back to us. So stopping it now with zero COVID strategy is the best option. And everything else, we will be playing whack-a-mole forever. Like, you can design booster shots for these. But do we really want to design booster shots when, again, 130 countries' citizens have not even gotten their first shot? Booster shots is going to create this even greater whack-a-mole situation where, again, only the super wealthy countries and citizens get protected. We don't want that long term. This is a social justice issue. This is a human rights issue.
I feel like it's, you know, this is it's similar to how we have learned the hard way that we needed a federal coordinated response, and leaving it up to states to take the lead, and in some places municipalities to do this piecemeal response, really was a big problem. There were states that never closed down businesses, that never closed down their bars and gyms and stuff like that. And it seems like this is similar. You need to have a global strategy to address a global pandemic. By the way, let's not be too pessimistic. Let me ask you this. When we say that a vaccine isn't 90% effective against these variants, it is still the case, or correct me if I'm wrong, that they are showing efficacy in terms of avoiding deaths and hospitalizations. Yes. And severe illness. So tell me about that so we don't leave people just desponding.
Right. And I want to emphasize this, that vaccines do work, and they work best for preventing severe things like deaths and mortality. In all these trials, not a single vaccinated person has actually died from the vaccine or from COVID. And I think that's a really good sign. Now, eventually, you know, there might be a death here and there, but when you're, you know, vaccinating millions and hundreds of millions of people, you're going to obviously see those. But preventing deaths and severe disease is obviously one of the key critical goals. And so basically boosting your immune system. But it also lowers the viral load. Basically, when you take the vaccine suppresses, teaches you how to recognize a virus, and basically trains you much faster so that you're prepared next time when you actually see the real virus. And so your body can respond faster and basically prevent the virus from creating a huge viral load in your body. So you're less infectious. If you do get infected, what you breathe out is a lower concentration. And therefore, you know, less likely to transmit to others. So vaccine has many, many things. Now, in some people, it will not work, right? But I think you have to take the precaution that a person still can be a mild to asymptomatic carrier of the virus, even with the vaccine. So this is why it's so critical that someone who's vaccinated still masks, because they could still be spewing the virus, especially asymptomatically, which we know is still a major source of transmission. Altogether, vaccines are good and they are safe. And whatever our adverse outcome now, we have to realize we have a placebo group, right, of people who haven't gotten it. And if you have 6% of people or 3% of people showing adverse events, but the placebo group shows the exact same amount, then that means it wasn't due to the vaccine, because the placebo group had just as much equal number of people. And so people sometimes don't understand that concept, that in the trial, if you compare to placebo and there's no excess risk compared to placebo, it means the vaccine is safe. And that's basically what we've seen for all major adverse outcomes. The only difference is a small fever or fatigue for like a few hours.
But site injection issues, right?
Say again?
Injection site issues, little minor thing.
Yeah, site issues.
My mom got a jab.
Fatigue for like half a day.
Yeah, my mom got a jab and her arm was sore for whatever, half a day or a day. Certainly a small price to pay for immunity or even partial immunity. So let's switch tacks a little bit. I'm using up more time than I asked you, as I almost always do with guests. I don't know what it is. I'm always like, it'll be 15 minutes and then I end up doing 20. But one of the big issues right now is reopening schools. Mm-hmm. It has seemed to me that one of the things that has been frustrating about this debate is that you have people who are saying, let's open up schools. And those people are often not the same people who are saying, let's throw tons of money at schools so that we can make them safe. Your thoughts on this? In other words, there's infrastructure that needs to be built. There's a whole variety of things that you need to do to open up schools safely. And also, and then the other part of that is that when you have high rates of community transmission, you have high rates of community transmission. And maybe somebody should have proposed that we can open up schools if we keep bars closed. Your right. thoughts?
So schools, you know, I have a kid and we need to reopen schools, but we have to reopen them safely, because reopening them carelessly only further endangers them and further continues the transmission and this pandemic. So we can't be lying to ourselves. There are people who are completely dismissive and say kids are completely safe, kids don't transmit. Those are absolute outright lies. You transmit obviously depending on what safety measures are in place. Some schools don't require masks. That's kind of dumb. Some schools have high school basketball with full audiences cheering in the stands without masks. There are people who are still wrestling, right, without any distance. Some of those things are kind of nuts. And of course, there's other things like what is the ventilation? Ventilation is really key, because in environmental health, one thing we teach is the solution to pollution is dilution. And the dilution here is ventilation. And the pollution here is the virus aerosols. And the aerosols do not care about 6 feet. They can fill up an entire room. Think of cigarette smoke. When you smoke, you can smell the smoke, right? For many, many meters and yards. And for a long period of time, even after the person who originally smoked and cigarette had disappeared. This is the same nature with these aerosols. They're airborne. They don't care about distance. They don't care if the person has left. In certain ways, bathrooms are poorly ventilated like that. Many classrooms in our schools are poorly ventilated. And so you have to think of, okay, can we afford HEPA filters? Can parents gather together if the school cannot afford it? You know, some people propose UV, obviously UV, UV as in installed in the HVAC system, in the machines, or in the upper air UV of, say, a gymnasium or cafeteria. Those cost a little bit more money, but they're obviously very improved safety a lot. But even if you can't afford any of these, there's still affordable things like there's something called a Corsi box. You take a box fan, pretty cheap, $10 to $15 box fan, and then you buy 5 filters to go with it, and you build a cube out of it, out of the filters, in which the box fan is one of the sides. And then you blow through with these high-quality filters through the box fan, and for under $50, you can have almost a HEPA filter equivalent quality indoor filtration system that's almost as good as the HEPA filters. Like there's solutions you can do, but the CDC has kind of not emphasized it, and it's kind of been really annoying. Like they mention it in their 33-page report recommendations, but it's been so downplayed. And you know, we don't have mass testing like many other countries do, in which you can get rapid testing and do it every day or every other day. We don't have that. And PCR testing, not every school can afford it every week for all the teachers and students, right? And you know, all these different things, and having, again, sports that are within 6 feet, that's not always safe, even if you wear a mask. So altogether, all these things, if you take all the precautions, right, like don't do all the high-risk sports, try to absolutely require masking, ventilate, install HEPA filters or upper air UV in large school complexes, have these air filters installed, and for school lunches, which is, again, back to indoor dining. If indoor dining is not safe, school lunches with lots of kids in the cafeteria unmasked is not safe either, right? There's no universe in which it's indoor dining is safe, but kids in the school lunches unmasked is. So I think school lunches should be outdoors. There are things we can do, but we just have to be realistic and carry them out. And not everything costs an arm and a leg. There are like practical solutions to everything.
I mean, it's been frustrating in the sense that it's all been politicized. And instead of having a conversation you know, productive conversation about how to do these things safely. It has always been this kind of false choice. Like we either don't do this thing at all, or we just do it half-ass and we say you only live once and you just jump into it. And both of those extremes are not good solutions. And, you know, we just haven't had the opportunity to have a serious conversation about all of this shit because Trump politicized the hell out of it and set a course early on where it is all, you know, polarized. Our information is polarized. Our view of the basics of public health is polarized. It is a huge mess. Eric, yeah. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. Yeah. I really do appreciate it. I'm going to have you back on in a couple of months and we'll see where we are if I could do so.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm hopefully in a couple of months we'll be a little bit better with this pandemic.
Yes, I'm hoping so.
Stay safe.
I'd also like to thank Leah Greenberg and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Ross Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, I'd like to thank you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
Kind of funny ocean. Everywhere. Hard times in the city, in a hard town by the sea. Ain't nowhere to run to. There ain't nothing here for free. Never gonna